This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
BFM 89.9, good morning. I'm Sharad Kutan. With me, Tan Chung Han and Brian Fernandez. Welcome, everybody, to a Tuesday.
Yes, good morning.
Yeah, hey. Good morning. Tomorrow's hump day, so that's halfway through the week.
And then it's all downhill from there.
No, it's not. No, it's because we're racing towards a three-day weekend.
Well, yeah, so downhill.
No, you know, it gets exciting. Downhill suggests it's going to be bad.
Well, but it also suggests that it's easier. It's all easy.
Oh, I see. You're taking the physical side, the acceleration.
Physics.
Yeah, physics. Yeah. But I'm talking about the idiomatic expression.
Oh, fine.
Downhill suggests
but
something
yes,
bad.
Tomorrow is hump day, yes. We're the eve of hump day, yes.
Okay. Now, the temperature and the weather, I think, has remained quite constant the last couple of weeks. Somewhere between 25 and 33 with intermittent rain. I think that's something we don't expect to change anytime soon. Also, a sad news overnight. Peter Salas, who is the voice of Wallace and Gromit, if anybody remembers that, important claymation work, and that really set off that whole genre.
No, absolutely. I think it was a series of three short films and then a one feature film. And I remember watching that in university a long time ago, obviously, but it was just fascinating. And it's so sad that, you know, one by one, as we get older, these icons or this little bits that you remember out of your past, they're all passing away.
Yeah, absolutely. So Peter Salas was 96. So no surprise there. Also,
well, I mean, apparently there's a hashtag that is being generated in line with this.
It's trending?
Trending. And it's a hashtag cracking toast. Perhaps you guys can enlighten me on this. Was this one of his catchphrases or something? Apparently it's one of his catchphrases, cracking toast.
Yeah. You know, the world of claymation and Wallace and Gromit and that kind of quintessentially English thing. I must admit, I was not a big, big fan, but the Wallace and Gromits I watched were great, good fun, and really worth the time. Quickly, also overnight, Bob Dylan delivers his Nobel Prize speech, which, interestingly enough, and the money that went with it was some $900,000 US dollars, and it was going to be forfeited if he didn't give his speech by June. Remember, he famously was awarded the thing. He didn't come for the award ceremony and such and such. But Bob Dylan finally caved in to the occasion. He noted Buddy Holly as his musical influence, but with literary influences, he referred to Herman Melville's Moby Dick, Homer's The Odyssey, and a novel called All Quiet on the Western Front.
I want to find out whether he actually donated that $900,000 that came part of the Nobel Prize. Was there any mention of that?
No, not at all. I think he's kept the money.
Yeah.
Why would he want to donate it? I don't know.
He might need it because, you know, you've got comments from the permanent secretary of the Swedish Academy who actually says, and I quote, "The Dylan adventure is coming to a close." So, you know, so perhaps, you know, all these institutions, as our producer calls it, you know, are perhaps seeing the twilights of their careers.
Okay, coming up, Ashes to Ashes by David Bowie, BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, good morning. I'm Sharad Kutan. That was Ashes to Ashes by David Bowie. Very, I had a poignant song for the morning, especially when we talked about the passing of Peter Salas, the voice of Wallace in Wallace and Gromit. And also, I think we left with a comment that you were making, Han, about just the passing of time. All that really so important in our lives today.
I apologize if this Tuesday morning begins on a morbid note for you guys.
I don't think death is morbid. I think, you know, I think death is just part of life. And it's part of the cycle. And some people believe you go on after death to something more. Others just feel that you go from ashes to ashes. You're part of, you know, the earthworms get you. And you fertilize the planet. A wonderful thought, I think.
Again, morbid, I think.
Really? Do you think it's morbid?
Well,
okay.
Well, I mean, again, I think maybe, you know, because this is coming from someone who's relatively younger than you. So maybe,
Okay, because you don't think of death. Yeah. I want to move on to the question of jokes. And Brian, you know, just looking at this article, I'm going to tweet it out shortly, is that this phenomena, how you put something out there in the world, and when people take offense, you say, oh, no, I was just joking. And because you do it in daily life sometimes, and then, of course, when it is done on, say, social media platforms, there's an amplification effect about that. You know, so the people who get offended, not just your friends, people who know you, but it's larger society. Have you ever encountered this phenomenon, Brian?
Well, I think that personally not, but I've seen this several times where people have, and I think we've seen this, whether it was politically or for when someone makes a religious comment, how that really is taken out of context and really amplified. And, well, it's really the sign of the times then that, people take things too literally.
Okay, so is it about here you're putting the blame on those who are reading the offense. But what about the person who uses I'm joking as an excuse?
Well, I think it very much depends on the medium, eh? You know, because if you look at some studies, and I remember this from my days in communication studies, although I'm not doing a very good job of it right now. But you've got, when it comes to communication, though, only about 7% of your communication is verbal. 93% is nonverbal. So essentially, once you get online, or if you chat via, say, you know, WhatsApp and all these other instant messaging tools, then you lose essentially 93% of what you're trying to convey, though, be it the tone or your gestures or even like a smirk, you know, for example. So, unlike Brian, who had the luxury of not having these kind of misunderstandings, I unfortunately, you know, have had these misunderstandings with some really, really good friends, and it really strained our relationships. So it got to the point where, you know, we actually have to make this rule where if you're joking, make sure you put the text, ha-ha. Either ha-ha or joke, or put an emoticon. Otherwise, I will not know if you're joking or not.
No, and I think that Han made a very good point about nonverbal communication. Take myself as an example. I move my hand. I'm very Italian in that sort of way, and move my hands a lot and gesture a lot. And that really helps to communicate ideas. You can't see that on radio.
When you say Italian, is that on the Sicilian side?
Probably.
The Neapolitan side? Which side of Italy are you from,
probably
Brian?
On the... You know, Indians and Italians have a lot of similarities culturally. I mean, surprisingly, if you actually go down to it, really, we're expressive, we are loud, we are dramatic.
I don't know. I think he's got to speak for himself here.
I'm not quite sure.
But you're from Klang, so you meet a lot of Indians. In fact, you're probably part Indian, aren't you?
I know,
culturally speaking.
Yeah, a few Italians in Klang as well. No, I'm kidding, joking, okay. Ha ha.
But okay, so this is the thing, right? So yeah. Once you put out something there and it does offend people, and then you try to use this excuse and you say, well, actually, it was a joke. What happens to your reputation, do you think?
I think your credibility-wise, a lot of times when you say that, then the next time you put out something, there's always a question mark on your friends' minds or so forth. Is he joking? Is he serious about this? And that really affects you tremendously, I think.
Also, according to this article on Wired.com, there is actually a phrase associated with this phenomenon being Poe's Law. And that's Poe's Law, right? So, you know, if you're listening right now, you can go check it out. So it's actually a thing whereby, you know, on the internet, it's impossible to tell who's joking, you know, but very often Poe's Law is used as a defense, as, you know, as an exit of sorts, as in, I didn't mean it that way, it was a joke. Poe's Law.
Okay. Well, coming up after this message, we will have the Allman Brothers and Rambling Man, BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, Brian Fernandez, Tan Chung Han, and myself, Sharad Kutin. And the morning run continues. You know, we stretch all the way from 6 to 10 a.m. in the morning. Now, a lot of you have just gotten up or are in the car, in which case you're heading off to drop your kids off at school or go to work. And I guess all of us have a theory about work because it takes up a good part of our day, about a third of our day. And, you know, my personal theory is that in fact, when it comes to work-life balance, I would like to see just more work. I think that's for the boss, by the way.
Well, that's an interesting thing because this article on Quartz talks about really the best part of your office life being your interaction with your colleagues. So So basically, it starts off talking about how when you were younger, or a teenager, or your university, your circle of friends, you do everything with them. And then after that, when you leave university or high school or, you know, a secondary school, and you get into the workforce, you then start to, those friendships drift away, and you start to spend more and more time with the people that you work with.
So, Han, so this would be equivalent to school. I mean, basically you're saying, Brian, that the school, the workplace becomes a substitute for school. And in some ways, those relationships that you had at school, the dynamics now match what you have at the workplace. Would that be correct?
Yeah, because one of the things is this, for example, it talks also about you having a work spouse. A lot of people have that literally as a work...
I don't know, do you have a school spouse though? I mean...
Well, that's your BFF, you know, your best friend forever.
Again, I'm just trying to digest this notion of a work spouse. I'm trying to think, who here at BFM would be my work spouse?
So the person who gives you support unconditionally, talks you through those low moments, shares those high moments with you, and for whom you cannot imagine, would not be there when you come to work the next day.
But all of a sudden, you know, I have a crisis on my hands, because does this have to be a monogamous relationship? Can I have multiple
Oh, I see what you mean.
Like,
why not?
Does it have to be exclusive though? Like, you know, will I get in trouble if I cheat on my work spouse? I don't know.
Well, the thing is, you know, it's just like when you were in school. Didn't you have three or four friends that you spent a lot of time with? And it's probably the same thing in at the workplace. A lot of times, you know, I know of friends who go on holidays together with their workmates.
Yeah, no, that's right. And that's very true. Now, going back to something that you mentioned earlier, Sharad, whereby, you know, work takes up like what, a third of our day, but it takes up what, two thirds at least of our lives, if not more, right? And so this idea of having that shoulder to lean on, this work spouse, so to speak, is very, very important. And, you know, certainly given how much time we spend within the work environment, you know, having that support group is, I think, just essential though to having to survive those two thirds of our lives.
Absolutely. But Han, you know, I know you meant it kind of facetiously, but there is this problem about kind of bleed between the in those relationships, right? Between, say, your life spouse, your home spouse, and your work spouse. And I wonder if there is, in fact, some sense of betrayal. You know, people argue with their spouses about how they're married to their jobs, so they start to spend more time with them than they want to spend with their home spouses.
But you know what people talk about now, spouses and work-life balance, and that's a big issue now in the workplace. How do you have a balance? Now, if you have a toxic workplace environment, that really affects your work-life balance, because basically, you know, it's a negative, that negativity then spills over into your home life.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's true too. But the question here is the work spouse necessary? I mean, is that really...
Yeah, absolutely. I would think so. And absolutely. And again, because otherwise, you know, if you're just going to be an isolationist, right?
Well, is that the option? I mean, you know, Brian, couldn't you just have reasonably professional but otherwise emotionally superficial relationships and get along just fine?
Go ahead, Han.
Well, I mean, yeah, okay, I think you can survive, no, but that, again, given how much time you spend in the work, you know, environment, I think that experience will be that much more fulfilling if you have a rich spouse or spouses.
Well, this is a question I think that's going to occupy us for not just the rest of the day, but perhaps the rest of the week. But we're coming up to the news about 6:30, the first bulletin of the day. But here's Young Blood and by The Naked and the Famous, BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, Brian Fernandez, Tan Chung Han, and myself, Sharad Kutin. And the morning stretch continues. That was Rock the Casbah by The Clash. Sorry, that's Casbah. Rock the Casbah by The Clash. One of my favorite bands from the 80s, the British band The Clash. Now, recently, and talking about clashing worldviews, we had the Ministry of Health come out and having to defend themselves over a video competition for teens and tweens where it encourages young people to make videos on how to prevent becoming gay and making that decision to become gay, if that's in fact a decision. We spoke to Punky Tech, who's a social activist, about this particular competition and what does it say about larger society?
In a sense, I want to say I'm not surprised, but yet I can't help but feel slightly betrayed by the fact that these are supposed to be our health professionals. Some of us are activists, as well as the people who are on the ground working on issues of HIV and AIDS, have been working closely with, you know, people from the Ministry of Health to create what they feel is an enabling environment. An enabling environment means, you know, an environment that does not discriminate the patients or people who are from marginalized communities. The reason is a lot of people who are from the LGBT communities or people living with HIV already live with a lot of fear that public services discriminate them. So this creates obstacles to our access to health. It only means that they will go to find a doctor or emergency services when it is too late. And we thought, you know, one way of solving this is to really promote the fact that the Ministry of Health does not discriminate at all. But now this competition.
So that was Punky Tech, a social activist, speaking about the Ministry of Health's video competition for teenagers. Now, the Ministry of Health has actually come out to say that they didn't intend this to be discriminatory. And but, you know, if you put this in context with other types of actions that have been taken, and, you know, so much so, I think, you know, this story, because of its controversy, got it, made it to the BBC website, and they were talking about this particular issue.
Yeah, several online media platforms have certainly carried this story, and apparently the, even here in Malaysia, they have a response, and they being the Ministry of Health, there's a response carried in the Malaysian Insight.com. Basically saying that this competition was carried out in the context of prevention being better than cure. Now, while this will certainly rankle, you know, us, and I guess us being those, you know, who are in the liberal sphere, so to speak, but, you know, I mean, if I can hark back to, say, my very conservative upbringing, you know, because for them, they are coming from a place of absolutes, whereby this is just morally wrong. There is that very clear and distinct line. So they're trying to prevent rather than cure individuals from falling into this kind of lifestyle, so to speak. You know? So again, I have that familiarity with where they're coming from. Again, not saying that it's right, but I can see how it certainly rankles, you know, those of us that are in the liberal realm, really.
You see, and the interesting thing about my personal views evolved over years. Now, I had a very conservative, just like Han, very, very conservative worldview in terms of homosexuality and stuff. And that changed over the years. I'm very, very sad that in this day and age, we have competitions like this. It just seems absurd. So
what the Ministry of Health is saying is that this competition wasn't meant to discriminate. But because their intention and what are the consequences of it are two different things. We might say that the Ministry of Health was disingenuous. How could it not know that such a competition? Because by presenting homosexuality as a disease that needs to be cured, you're already in the realm of bias and prejudice, right? And in the realm of discrimination. So what is it that was the subtext of the competition that we're giving? Perhaps to give them some, to be generous in our interpretation, perhaps they didn't intend to do that. And what they just intended to do was to alert people to the kinds of choices they're faced as children or young people.
But unfortunately, the community itself is so stigmatized. I think the activists made a very good point that it would then really prevent them from seeking help when they really needed it or when they need it moving forward until it's too late. And that's really not something that a health ministry should be encouraging. You should be encouraging early intervention.
Well, I mean, to be fair, you know, I'm looking at the flyer of sorts for this competition, and it's got this tagline: "Value yourself and practice healthy lifestyle." And so I would almost give the ministry the benefit of the doubt in that, okay, fine. Because, again, from their policy standpoint, it's driven by these moral absolutes that, you know, this is something that we have to prevent, right? I mean, hence, inadvertently labeling, you know, homosexuality as a disease of sorts to be cured. You know, but, again, I think this is another instance whereby, you know, it's very hard to detract policy from the underlying morals. And whether you like it or not, I believe that is a value value that a majority of Malaysians hold on to.
Well, even if you have any views on this, you can always tweet us at BFM or send us a WhatsApp 0162019000. That's 0162019000. That's on WhatsApp or an SMS. Tell us what you think and we'll carry this conversation further. We'll be back after this, BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, I'm Sharad Kuddin, with me Tan Chung Han and Kusu Chuang. Just joining us, this morning stretch is almost over and he's only just come. Now tell us, the stories that are going to be animating our discussion for the rest of the morning.
Well, it's only Tuesday and it's still a bit of a dry news day in terms of local news stories. But what we've got is a diplomatic row in the Middle East because Qatar has just been sidelined by its neighbouring countries, the Saudis, the UAE, the United Arab Emirates and a couple of other countries. They've been sidelined because they've been blamed and they've been, in a way, scapegoated for the war on terror. And diplomatic tensions have escalated. Residents have been told to leave the country. Air flights have stopped, and it's all coming to a bit of a boil, actually.
You know, this is, of course, going to be very interesting on a political end as well. We're going to be talking after the 8:30 news to an expert on terrorism. But some part of it will have to be a discussion about the war that the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia is prosecuting in Yemen, which is causing incredible devastation in that country. I think UN's already come out to say there are near famine conditions in Yemen today.
So given those kind of geopolitical risks, you know, that's going to be one of the questions I'll be asking Joe Quinden, who is the chief market strategist of the U.S. Trust Bank of America Private Wealth Management. That's coming up after the 7 a.m. news. So we'll be asking him, you know, how do investors view these kind of developments in the Middle East?
So next up, Malaysian exports.
Yeah, so there's a bit of an interesting recovery trend going on in Malaysia because what we've seen is our April exports jumping 20.6% from a year ago. And that dovetails quite nicely with Malaysian GDP in the first quarter of a 5.6% jump. The first quarter GDP numbers was actually faster than expected. And this 20.6% April exports jump was also better than expected. So it kind of just shows that the Malaysian economy is on a bit of a recovery trend. And the recovery meant the ringgit is appreciating. Foreign fund inflows into Bursa Malaysia have now been the case for 17 straight weeks. And now foreign fund buying is at 10.14 billion ringgit as in May, which is in a way massive because, foreigners have been buying local stocks on an incredible tear.
And if I can quote Umar, who was anchoring in your place, Sharad, yesterday, maybe it's time to dissolve Parliament already with all this good news going around. Hey?
Actually, that's a good point.
Yeah, so credit to Umar there. Yeah.
But the question is, how does it affect the man on the street? Because it's all great for businesses and people might be thinking statistically this is great. But if the cost of living is still a pressure on people, will this be, in fact, a winner for anybody? I mean, will people say, oh, exports are great, I'm going to vote for the incumbent, whoever the incumbent may
be. Correct. You still have to have the trickle-down effect, which hasn't really happened. Because people are still bleeding in the streets in a way because, you know, their pockets are still, you know, thin in terms of where the nickels and dimes should be.
Also in the news, this China company and movements on the Bursa.
Yeah. So Wang Sheng has seen a takeover offer for their shares. And I think the shares actually rose to parity with the takeover offer yesterday, which also dovetails a little bit with China Automobile. Now, China Automobile has seen the share price move in the opposite direction because they failed to file the financial accounts in time. So I guess in a way for Wang Sheng, this has been a bit of a rescue for them because overall, Bursa Malaysia listed China companies have not been doing at all well. HB Global, Xingchuan, Multisports, all of them are trading very, very low single-digit, in fact, very, very low single-digit PEs because shareholders don't really, they don't really believe the financial accounts of these China companies.
Yeah, you know, I mean, when you're looking at China Automobiles, I mean, their share price right now, as of close yesterday, they were trading at half a cent.
Yeah.
Not even 1 cent, half a cent. At its high back in 2013 or so, you're looking at 41 cents per share. You know, now it's half a cent. So just goes to show the decline in China Automobile.
We'll be coming up to the news at 7 o'clock. But before that, we have Sometimes by Luke Bell, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, The Business Station.